and distress, or a mixture of both, gives evidence concerning the religious and irreligious activities of one's past and future lives. In other words, what you are seeing now in terms of that which is going on in your life. Happiness, distress, mixture of both, painful situations, pleasurable situations. This will give you evidence about how religious or irreligious you were in your previous life. And also, what you're doing in this life will give you evidence about what you can expect in the next life. So, it is being explained by the Yamadutas that look at what's going on around you. Why should you think that these conditions that are going on around you now only exist in this lifetime? That is the way we would look at it with contaminated intelligence due to our Western upbringing. We would just consider this life as all in all, and we look at the circumstances of this life and in no way connect them to a past or future life. But the Bhagavatam is training us to think differently. And why should we not think differently? Even if you want to be logical, why should you conclude that what is happening in this life only happens in this life? Just like, why should you look at springtime and conclude that this is the only season? I think it's spring now, yeah? Or it's summer. This is the only season ever in which flowers bloom and fruits blossom. This is the only season that's ever happened. You wouldn't do that? No. Everybody understands that nature moves in cycles. So why can't you understand that your life also moves in cycles? Past lives, present lives, future lives. Why should you conclude that the happiness and distress that you're going through now will only be gone through in this life? In other words, why should you think that all the various circumstances that surround you, they've never surrounded you before, and they'll never surround you again? In other words, if you're going to use logic and reason, then why not use logic and reason the other way? Instead of assuming what I'm seeing around me now, in terms of circumstances and conditions, these things will only happen once. It's like looking at the present spring, and flowers will only bloom once this time. Never again, never happened before. Fruits only blossom this time. We should only be concerned with that. Why do you think like that? Why not think that, look at the fruits and flowers blossoming and blooming now. It happened in the past and it will happen again. Similarly, look at your life and see the happiness and distress I'm experiencing now. I've done it in the past, it's come to me in the past, and it will happen again in the future. In other words, logic is actually not the proof of things, but logic can be used to bring you to the truth. Sometimes we're used to hearing Prabhupada speak so many analogies. And this verse is also an analogy. Springtime in the present indicates the nature of past springtime. Prabhupada pointed out the actual proof is not the analogy or the logic. It's like we're speaking with logic now. This verse is based on logic. The actual proof of the Siddhanta, of the perfect Veda conclusion, is not the logic or the analogy or the example. It's like when we're preaching, we give so many examples. For example, it's like this, and just like so-and-so. Devotees following in Prabhupada's footsteps, they like giving many examples to illustrate situations. The proof is not in the example. Even when Srila Prabhupada speaks, when the spiritual master speaks, example, just to make things clearer, that is not the proof in of itself. The shastra is the proof. Examples are meant to bring us toward the shastric conclusion, and logic is meant to help us to approach and see the superior intelligence and perfection of the conclusions of the shastra. But if you're actually looking for proof, then it is there in the scriptures. Shabda pramana, the evidence of sound vibration. We should remember that. after all is said and done, after all examples are given in preaching and all colorful descriptions and skillful use of logic, our whole Krishna consciousness rests on the scriptures. Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Nectar of Devotion, so many of them. Bhakti is not sentimental. You see, you can glimpse various slivers of bhakti in the lives of people following the so-called religions that are present today. There's no doubt about that. You'll see some sliver of bhakti, some sentimental equivalent. But bhakti is never sentimental. Real bhakti, might as well just say bhakti itself, is founded on knowledge and detachment. Therefore, in the Bhagavatam first canto, it is stated, Satchitadana Munayo, Janam Vayagya Vipchaya. Bhakti has solid components of knowledge and renunciation. It's not a religious sentiment. Religious sentiment is one thing, bhakti is another. Bhakti has solid components, a constituent. One should be very learned in the scriptures so that you understand yourself what you are doing and you can explain to others. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, he who knows in truth my great power and glory engages in devotional service with great intensity. So that is the advantage of understanding Krishna in truth as he's presented himself or as his devotees have presented him. Your devotional service becomes much more powerful. The more you try to know about Krishna, the more your intelligence will be satisfied, and the more your intelligence will urge you onward. Do more service. Do more service. Also, vairagya, renunciation. That is also a firm pillar of bhakti. No one can engage in devotional service while at the same time being absorbed in sinful activity. No one can engage fully in devotional service while practicing sinful activity. Therefore, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Yesham ta antikatam pabam, jananam punyakarmanam. Only when you come to the end, antikata papa, the end of all sinful activities, then you can actually be qualified to understand what is religion. Prabhupada would many times explain this verse saying, this is the beginning of theism, the end of sinful life. When your sinful life ends, that is when theistic life begins. This is a very bottom line definition of theism versus atheism. Theism doesn't simply mean, I believe in God. According to Prabhupada's standards, theism begins when you reach an end to sinful activity. This puts spiritual life in great perspective, especially for those who are trying to follow Christianity. They, unfortunately, due to not good teachers, they're thinking that I just believe in Jesus, that's all it takes, and then I should be ready to understand more and more about love of Jesus and love of God. But meanwhile, these sinful activities continue to embarrass them. So how to make life simple for them as well as us? Yesham sa antagatam papam jananam punyakamanam. Only one who has put a stop to sinful activities can actually claim to be pious and then engage with great determination in devotional service. That's why the regular principles are very important for us, because as soon as one breaks the regular principles, you will notice, hopefully it will never happen, but for one who does that, one notices that you lose your determination to serve Krishna. Of course, sometimes, especially in the lives of young devotees, there can be some unintentional slips. Just like if you're been smoking cigarettes all your life, and then you move into the temple, and you consciously give up cigarette smoking, but then one day you're walking out on the street doing some errand for Krishna, and some or other, you meet an old friend, and you just have a cigarette, and without thinking, you just take a cigarette. These things it's unfortunate, but it can happen. That is an unintentional deviation. But when we consciously plan, now I will engage in sinful activity, never mind the rules, who cares, then this is a great destructive effect on our devotional life. So let us remember that theism begins with the end to sinful activity. Why should we look at the circumstances of this life and think the only time these things have happened? Why not think the other way? That is the plain challenge of the Bhagavata. Think the other way. In fact, if you're intelligent, you will think the other way. Just like spring comes again and again with its concomitant conditions, similarly, there'll be happiness and distress for you in the past. There was that in the past. It'll be there in the future, just like you're seeing it now. That you're seeing it now indicates it existed in the past, and it indicates it'll exist in the future. It took me some years of meditating on this verse to grasp what's going on, because I remember Prabhupada lecturing on this verse, and he would speak very convincingly. This shows you that happiness and distress, it occurred in the past, it will occur in the future, just like spring is here with its conditions. That means spring was there in the past with those same conditions. It will be there in the future with those same conditions. I said, wait a minute, this doesn't prove anything. This doesn't prove that you had a past life or a previous life. So it takes some time of listening submissively. Well, the Bhagavatam says that this indicates that. Let me think about it. Let me accept the Bhagavatam's line of thought, the Bhagavatam's way of reasoning, and try to get some insight in that way. In other words, if we're going to take advantage of Srimad Bhagavatam, we have to have very humble intelligence. Because so many times you'll find the Bhagavatam contradicts the patterns of our normal thinking. For example, when you try to tell someone that they had a previous life, many times they will say, I don't remember my death. That's the proof. I don't remember I died. So how can you say I had a previous life? Of course, then you can just point out, do you celebrate your birthday? Oh yes. Do you like when people celebrate your birthday? Oh yes. Do you remember your birth? No. You don't remember your birth, yet you're so eager to have your birthday celebrated. Similarly, you don't remember your death. The fact that you don't remember it doesn't mean it didn't happen to your previous death. Nowadays, though, you're seeing a whole lot of people who accept reincarnation. Oh yes, no problem. We know the soul goes from body to body. This is not our only life. We had a life before, and we'll have a life in the future. Therefore, no need to worry about anything. We're spirit soul. Whatever happens, happens. We're eternal. You get it? There's going to be no death for us. We'll die and come back, and those are the same things we're going through now, and we'll just learn our lessons more and become more expert at sense gratification. What's wrong? Soul's eternal. So what are you Hare Krishna's fighting this for? everybody's spiritual. Okay? Case closed. Finished. You were spiritual in the past. You're spiritual now. You'll be spiritual in the future. Many lives. On and on and on it goes. That's it. What do we need you for? Of course, the same verse can apply. Yesham antagatam papam. Only when you reach an end to sinful activity can you actually understand, or can you actually begin to understand your spiritual identity. Otherwise, it's just a lot of talk. While saying, oh, I'm spiritual, I know I have future lives and past lives, they're simply engaging in material activity. Just like it becomes the equivalent of Christianity. The Christians say, I believe in Jesus. Meanwhile, they're totally absorbed in material activity. Now you've got so many people today who say, I believe we're not the body, I believe we're spirit soul. Meanwhile, they're totally engaged in material activity. The whole point of Krishna consciousness is how to actually experience yourself as spirit soul. Not just how to talk about it. What is the use in saying, I am spirit soul, and we continue to engage in material activity? In fact, the more one engages in material activities, the more covered over we become. So much so that you can go around day and night talking about I'm spirit soul, yet you're totally absorbed in the three modes of nature, totally absorbed in piling up sinful reactions for yourself. The whole point is that people don't understand they are controlled. They must live according to the laws of God. The happiness and distress they have in this life comes by their following or not following the laws of God. And similarly, their behavior in this life, whether they follow the laws of God or not, whether they follow Dharma or not, that determines their happiness and distress in the next life. But they don't see it that way. They see it that the happiness and distress just comes to you either of its own accord, or you generate it, you're in control of it completely, and you just go on living life after life, and gradually you become more expert at just getting happiness and no distress. It's all up to you. And they make zero effort to find out what is Dharma. Absolutely zero effort. This is not the human form of life. The human form of life means find out what are the laws governing existence. Otherwise, you have no choice but to engage in sinful life. Ignorance is no excuse. If you don't know, and yet you're acting in so many ways, you're going to pile up so many sinful reactions for yourself. It's your duty as a human being to find out. You cannot just say, well, I didn't know. If you have a human body, if you look in the mirror and you see a human body, that means find out what's going on. You must do that. And that is our basic preaching stance. If you're a human being, you must find out what is Dharma. The fact that you have happiness and distress now means you acted in certain ways in the past. You're acting now. That will bring about happiness and distress in the future. Do you want the best kind of material happiness? Or do you want to even get beyond all kinds of material happiness? That choice is yours. And you must get the knowledge how to make that choice. So if we think about this verse, we'll start to accept the line of thinking, the pattern of reasoning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, rather than just our own contaminated thinking. If there's a past life, why can't I remember it? Why don't I know about my previous death? All I know is now, therefore that's all that there is. The Bhagavatam does not teach you to think in that way. The Bhagavatam is teaching you to think. If you see conditions now, then you should know those conditions existed in the past and conditions will exist in the future. Now, sometimes when your intelligence rebels against this, just consider nature. Everybody accepts that nature goes in cycles. So why not accept that your human, why not accept that your material existence goes in cycles? Everybody accepts that, as we're saying, spring comes with its various conditions, again and again. So why not accept that material life with its various conditions, its fruits of happiness and distress, will come again and again? An intelligent person wants to get to the root of all this. How is it that I'm experiencing sometimes happiness, sometimes distress? What is the system? And then again, for someone who's very intelligent, they don't want anything to do with material distress or material happiness. Narada Muni says, Tasyaiva Heta, Kayaheta Kovido. If you're actually a kavi, a learned person, you will not endeavor for anything that's available from the lower planetary systems to the higher planetary systems. You want nothing available in that realm. Alabhyate Dukhava. Tasyaiva Heto, Prayateta Kovido. What is it that you want? You want things that are not available within the three modes of material nature. You want things that are not available within the field of pious and impious activity. That is the perfection of life. And as long as you don't get that which is beyond material endeavor, then you go through these repeated cycles spring, autumn, summer, winter, past life, present life, future life. Now we are making a concerted effort to turn people's attention to Krishna. In this way, they can first of all learn how to live properly according to religious principles, and secondly, they can become attracted to Krishna. By becoming attracted to Krishna, they are protected from performing sinful activities.
And who cannot be attracted to Krishna?
Damodar, the month of Kartik has just started for us here, and every time we sing the Damodarastika prayers, you get such a picture by the grace of the acharyas of the all-attractive beauty of Krishna. In this world, everybody likes little children, seeing how little children play. So Krishna, he knows that. He demonstrates his bal pastimes as a little baby and attracts everybody's mind. Whatever attractiveness you see in a little baby, just like our devotees who have little babies, and the little baby keeps falling in the temple. Everybody looks, even the brahmacharis look, oh. How cute, how how fresh, how innocent. So that attractiveness of that situation is there because Krishna has his childhood pastimes which have unlimited attraction. So therefore we start to sing, Namamishram Satchidanandarupam. First, you offer your obeisances to Krishna, the Supreme Controller, Ishvara. In other words, you're not just worshipping any little baby. You are worshipping Ishvara, who's appearing as a little baby. Namam Ishvaram Satchidanandarupam. And what is the nature of this baby who is Ishvara? His body is Satchidananda, eternity, knowledge, and bliss. What else about this baby Krishna? Lasa kundalam gokule brajamanam. His earrings that decorate his cheeks, they swing to and fro. In fact, the earrings are made beautiful by the body of baby Krishna. It's not that the earrings make the body of Krishna beautiful. The earrings look beautiful because the body of Krishna is beautiful. Complete reversal. For example, in the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Uddhava explains, Param Param Bhushana Bhushanangam. Krishna's body is the ornament of the ornament. Now, everybody knows you put on ornaments to make your body look good. But actually, Krishna's ornaments, they are made to look good by Krishna's body. Therefore, Namam Ishvaram Satchidanandarupam. Lata Kundalam Gokule Brajamana. Krishna is the center of attraction in Gokula, and everybody is watching how his earrings swing to and fro. His earrings look so beautiful because Krishna's body is so beautiful. And devotees relish everything about Krishna, how Krishna does things, even down to the most minute detail, the swinging of his earrings. There's nothing normal in terms of being mundane about Krishna. There's nothing boring. So when you sing those prayers, you're made to focus by the mercy of the acharyas on every little thing about Krishna in his childhood pastime. All the details. You're even taught to focus on the rope that bound Krishna. Mother Yasoda took a rope and bound him. So you offer your obeisances to the rope. It is spiritual paraphernalia. How can the Maya bodies understand? what kind of transcendentalists are you offering obeisances to a rope that bound a baby boy that's blue? This is not spiritual life. Real spiritual life is the oneness beyond all this. No, you cannot get beyond Damodar, Lord Damodar. And it gets to be bewildering sometimes. Even Lord Brahma becomes bewildered. What happened when the cowherd boys and Krishna were roaming in the forest of Vrindavan? They sat down on the bank of the Jamuna to have their lunch, but then the cows wandered far away. Krishna told his cowherd boyfriend, "Don't worry, you don't be in anxiety. I will go look for the cows." So Krishna went off to look for the cows, and of course, then Brahma came and thought that he stole the cows and cowherd boys. And you all know in the Brahma Vimohana Leela, how Krishna bewildered Lord Brahma. So then at the end of that pastime, Brahma offered many glorious prayers to Krishna. These are very wonderful prayers. So many verses that Prabhupada would always quote are contained in these prayers by Lord Brahma. You'll find them in the Krishna book, as well as the 14th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam. So, after Brahma offered these wonderful prayers, Krishna was just silent. Krishna is standing there, young cowherd boy, with food in his hand, looking for his cows, and Brahma has just finished offering all these prayers, and Krishna is silent. So, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments that why was the young boy Krishna silent? Because he's absorbed in his role as a cowherd boy, and here Lord Brahma is glorifying him as the cause of all causes, the supreme absolute truth, the complete whole, and Krishna is just thinking, I'm just a cowherd boy looking for my cows and my cowherd boyfriend. Who is this four-headed Brahma? Where did he come from? what's his problem? Making all these majestic prayers to some supreme, majestic absolute. I'm just a cowherd boy. In fact, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur points out in the purport to that verse that it was an actual turnabout on Lord Brahma, because the reason why Brahma enacted this whole thing of trying to steal the cows and cowherd boys was he was momentarily doubtful. Is this really Krishna, the Supreme Absolute Truth? This young boy playing with his cows and cowherd boys, is that really the cause of all causes? He looks so innocent, so tender. I don't know. Let me make a test. I will see. I am the great Brahma. I will contrive a test. We will see if this is really Krishna or not. We will see his power, whether he has power or not. Otherwise, perhaps he's just an ordinary cowherd boy. So, then of course he realized otherwise by Krishna's great display of creating Vishnu Tattva cows and cowherd boys. So then Brahma offered all these glorious prayers, very wonderful prayers, but Krishna was silent. The Acharyas say Krishna was indicating, didn't you think I'm just an ordinary cowherd boy? So what are you offering me all these prayers for? Anyway, I am a cowherd boy, and I'm looking for my cow. Who are you, four-headed Brahma? Where did you come from? What's your purpose? In these ways, Krishna delights his devotees with ever-fresh pastimes, and the more you think of them, the more you become attracted to Krishna. And it's very easy to become attracted to Krishna when we follow the guidelines of the Acharyas and the scriptures. They teach us how to approach Krishna. They train our intelligence how to be humble in hearing from Krishna. Therefore, every detail is important. Just as hearing about Krishna's pastimes are important, similarly, hearing verses like today is very important. Springtime in the present indicates the nature of springtimes in the past and future. Sometimes devotees make the mistake of, oh, this is not nectar. We want to hear the nectar. Everything in Srimad Bhagavatam is nectar. So we should not think, I only want to hear this section of the Bhagavatam and not that section. If our intelligence has not been trained to understand the sweet juice in every verse of the Bhagavatam, then our attraction for Krishna will be artificial. For one who has implicit faith in the Vedic literatures and the spiritual master, prakashante mahatmana, the Vedic truths become revealed to you. It's not theoretical understanding. If you have firm faith in Srimad Bhagavatam book and the person Bhagavatam, then the Vedic truths contained in the Srimad Bhagavatam will become manifest to you, not just a theoretical belief. So there must be some faith, there must be some shraddha, but that's not a blind faith. The Bhagavatam book and the Bhagavatam person give you every reason, every logical and beautiful reason why you should have faith. And then, based on that faith, you get realization. Prakashante Mahatmana. You'll be a Mahatma, a great soul. It'll become revealed to you. Prakash. Like the sun rising at dawn. Nothing theoretical. Prakashante, that's not a theoretical word in Sanskrit. It will happen. You'll experience. These are very inferior words compared to Prakashante Mahatmana. So first you read. We try to tell people. Just hear the glory of these books. See how people are living, how devotees are living based on these books. Certainly you can appreciate their great glory. Now you read for yourself. And by reading and studying these books in the association of devotees, they will get faith. And their faith will be rewarded. No blind faith. No sentimental religious belief. Krishna consciousness has nothing to do with those things. Purvarupam, the past religious or irreligious condition. Vapashyati, completely observed. Anumimamsate, he considers. Apurvam, the future condition. Manasa, with his mind. Bhagavan, who is omnipotent. Aja, as good as Lord Brahma. The omnipotent Yamaraj is as good as Lord Brahma, for while situated in his own abode, or in everyone's heart, like the Paramatma, he mentally observes the past activities of a living entity, and thus understands how the living entity will act in future lives. Purpose. One should not consider Yamaraj an ordinary living being. He is as good as Lord Brahma. He has the complete cooperation of the Supreme Lord, who is situated in everyone's heart. And therefore, by the grace of the super soul, he can see the past, present, and future of a living being from within. The word anumimamsate means that he can decide in conjunction, in consultation with the super soul. Anu means following. The actual decisions concerning the next lives of a living entity are made by the super soul, and they are carried out by Yamaraj. Om Jnana Pirman Andrasya Jnanan Dina Shalakya Chakshu Mani Kamyena Kajmaya Shri Yudhaya. Generally we're accustomed to having the fancy word Bhagavan applied only to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. Bhagavan, I'm sure most of you know, Bhaga means opulence, Van means possessor. Bhagavan refers to one who is incalculably deep in all six opulences, which have been carefully described by the Vedic acharyas. Particularly Parashara Muni has said there are six opulences that you can see in existence amongst the living entities: wealth, strength, renunciation, beauty, knowledge, and fame. Of course, these days everyone understands that wealth is an opulence, or beauty is an opulence, fame, but renunciation? In this day and age, renunciation is looked down upon as something very grotesque, very perverse. But in normal human civilization, we were just speaking with some devotees last night about normal human civilization and how things should go on in a human society as opposed to an animal society. So, in normal human civilization, renunciation is glorious. And people are encouraged to increase their detachment. And even if persons are slack in their own detachment, they're always ready to credit others with renunciation. The ability to thrive amidst so many opulences and yet not claim them as your own and not try to use them for your own enjoyment, that is very glorious. Therefore, renunciation is also an opulence. How it is that Krishna can display unlimited depth in beauty, strength, knowledge, fame, and yet still also unlimitedly display the opulence of renunciation. All these things, of course, are inconceivable. Therefore, although Krishna's pastimes, on the one hand, look human, and therefore they're attractive to conditioned souls, just like yesterday we were talking about the Baal Krishna pastimes, Krishna as a baby. So, human beings, they like little infants. They look so cute and cuddly. Of course, the mothers have great dedication cleaning the stool and urine of the little kid. Anyway, if you don't have to take care of a kid, it's not your own. It definitely looks very cute and cuddly. So, there's a sliver of attraction in these mundane infant pastimes, so-called, because everything is coming from Krishna. But in Krishna, you see the unlimited attractiveness of everything. Just like this is Kartik. We are glorifying the unlimited attractiveness of Krishna's baby pastime, Baal Krishna pastime. That is the best way to focus on these things that you see in ordinary existence. If you're attracted, for example, if you're attracted to baby pastimes, then absorb your mind in Krishna's pastimes as a baby with Mother Yashoda. That is the intelligent thing to do. And Krishna consciousness is meant for our intelligence. So, on the one hand, Krishna's pastimes, they are attractive because they appear to be human. Or there are things that human beings can relate to. On the other hand, Krishna's pastimes are always inconceivable. So there's two edges to this situation. Krishna's pastimes are very inviting because they resemble human pastimes, and at the same time, as Prabhupada writes in Nectar of Devotion, there's a danger in Krishna's pastimes, because although they appear to be human, they're not. They're all inconceivable. Especially when you get into the matter of Krishna's dancing with the gopis, his Madhurya Leela, his Madhurya Ras, you can really get yourself into hot water very quickly by thinking these are mundane and not appreciating how these affairs of Krishna are the most confidential and require a liberated mentality to understand. In other words, one has to be free from all tinges of material nature to properly understand Krishna's intimate Vrindavan pastimes. So, this word Bhagavan refers to Krishna as the possessor of six opulences in unlimited infinite depth. And Jiva Goswami has also added another meaning of Bhagavan. He's one of our foremost preceptors in our line of Vasistha succession. He has stated that in Sanskrit the word Bhagavan means one who is so attractive that everyone must irresistibly serve him. And that is certainly true of Krishna. You will serve Krishna directly through the spiritual energy, or you will serve Krishna indirectly through the material energy. But everyone is attracted to Krishna, directly or indirectly. Therefore, a devotee is one who uses his or her intelligence how to see that whatever I'm attracted to, it's there in its proper expression in Krishna. And as soon as I look for attractiveness in the material nature and try to grab it, that's when my problems begin. Even before I try to grab it, just contemplating, looking at so-called attractiveness in material nature destroys my intelligence, it corrodes my spiritual integrity. Prahlad Maharaj also says like that. Your problems with material life begin simply from the plan-making stage. In other words, he's explaining that material life is not simply a problem when you do things, when you actually act, and then you cause yourself problems. No, he says that material life causes problems as soon as you begin to plan in your intelligence what to do. From the moment you start making plans, that's when your distress begins. It's not that, you know, the distress only happens after you do things and you get really entangled and after a while the distress comes. No, that is not true. Just with your intelligence trying to concoct how you're going to be the enjoyer, how you're going to be satisfied, how this world is meant for your pleasure, or at least a few things in this world and a few people are meant for your pleasure. As soon as you start to calculate like that, making plans, you can mark it. That is where your distress begins. So you should make a study of how that is so. The Shastra said it is, the Shastra says it is true, so we accept it in that way. Now we see that the word Bhagavan is also applied to Yamaraj. And the Bhagavatam in Prabhupada's purport inform us that this word can also apply to very powerful living entities who are not independently powerful, but by the grace of Krishna can assume extraordinary magnitude, extraordinary effects. Narada Muni is sometimes called Bhagavan. And now you're hearing that Yamaraj is called Bhagavan. So, it is never the case that these very powerful devotees are the origin of their own power. No. As you're hearing in today's verse and purport, Yamaraj works in complete coordination with the super soul. Prabhupada ends the purport saying, the actual decisions concerning the next lives of the living entities are made by the super soul, and they're carried out by Yamaraj. Our goal is also to learn how to act in complete conjunction, in complete coordination with the super soul. The super soul is known as Chaitya Guru, the spiritual master in the heart. And the spiritual master, from without, trains the disciple how to be sensitive to the spiritual master within. There is no contradiction between the Lord in the heart and the instructions of the bona fide spiritual master from without. They both work as a team. Therefore, the great devotee Uddhava prays in the Bhagavatam that transcendental poets, even if they had a life as long as Brahma, who knows how long Brahma's life is? 311 trillion years. You can't even think about that. So even if transcendental poets had a lifetime as long as Brahma, they could not express enough their gratitude to Krishna. Why? Because Uddhava says, Krishna appears in two ways to deliver the conditioned soul, as the Lord in the heart, and as the spiritual master from without. Based on this teamwork, in other words, the conditioned soul in no way can complain that he or she is being neglected by the Lord, abandoned by the Lord. Uddhava is saying the opposite. Sometimes in our cultivation of Krishna consciousness as beginners, as neophytes, even in the intermediate stages, we sometimes feel, oh, I'm abandoned. Who's noticing me? Who cares for me? Who appreciates my effort? But Uddhava, he's showing us what the real situation is. We should be always glorifying Krishna because in two ways, he's always taking care of us, from within and without. Prabhupada explains that the job of the bona fide spiritual master is to train the disciple how to be sensitive so that one day the disciple can hear the Lord in the heart. But if we try to do this prematurely, then we're in big trouble. I know it's very popular these days to go around saying that just listen to the voice within. Just use your intuition. Just consult inside yourself and then you'll know what to do. And as we were saying a few days ago, that this even gets worse, in which you're told that the secrets of mind-body medicine now reveal to you that if your body feels good about something, that's the right thing to do. And if your body feels uncomfortable about something, you know it's the wrong decision. So in this way, everybody, while claiming to be so subtle and so spiritual, they're just trapped on the same old bodily platform. How does my body feel? And they make decisions like this. And people are actually thinking like this. They think it's very intelligent and very broad-minded that the body is nature's instrument for giving you indication. And nature is perfect. That means when the body feels uncomfortable, nature is telling you, don't do that. Austerity is uncomfortable. Don't do it. Sense control is uncomfortable. Don't do it. And when the body gives you comfortable signal, yes, that means it's good. So you can imagine what's going on under the guise of all this. Constantly serving me with preety, with affection, I give the intelligence how to come to me. Now this verse cannot be applied very loosely. Prabhupada would get very angry when devotees would start giving him examples about how so many people say they're talking to God, So many people say that God is giving them direction. Many so-called Christians say like that. And of course, you've got the so-called New Age influence, which is everywhere these days, and everyone's talking about that. Just listen to the voice of him. Prabhupada would get very angry. In fact, he'd bang his table. In Bhagavad Gita, who does Krishna say he talks to? Only those who have preeti, spiritual affection, who are serving him with affection. Krishna talks to them. Why do you think that Krishna is talking to all these fools and rascals? He says, no, only if you have affection through devotional service will I talk to you. So the job of the spiritual master is to train the disciple, to prepare for Krishna to talk to you. And that is a very strict and exciting and demanding process, demanding of our love. Krishna wants to see how painstakingly you perform your devotional service. It is not that Krishna needs anything from us. He already has everything. But we are very desperate for a chance to show our love to Krishna. That is what devotional service means. When you get a service, it means you have gotten an opportunity from Krishna to show how much you care, to show how considerate you'll be, to show how much pains you'll take in the execution of that service, whatever service it is. And through being very painstaking and careful about serving Krishna, that is how your love of Krishna develops. Therefore, the bona fide spiritual master is always monitoring the disciple's performance of devotional service, because that will determine how sensitive they'll be to hear the Lord in the heart. And Krishna does promise in the Gita, Sadami Buddhi Yogam Tam, I personally will give you the intelligence, the Buddhi Yoga, how to come to me. He promises that. It's not that Krishna consciousness simply produces persons who can't make their own minds up and can't make decisions. We don't make our own minds up, and actually we don't. Our goal is not to make our own decisions. Our goal is to hear the decisions of Krishna. That is what Yamaraj is doing. He's got his job because he can hear Krishna's instruction. And in conjunction with the super soul, he arranges the fate of the living entities in terms of reactions to their karmic activities. Obviously, we have a lot of work to do, but it's good work, to say the least, because it will revive our love for Krishna. Krishna doesn't need us, but quite finally, he's given devotional service. And we should remember how rare it is to have a chance to serve Krishna. In Nectar of Devotion, we'll read that Krishna doesn't easily give out opportunities for service, because by devotional service, he can be conquered. But when Krishna appears as Lord Chaitanya, service opportunities are distributed everywhere, just like rainwater during a flood. The more we can simply do devotional service without so many mental complexities, the more happy we'll be, because that is our natural situation. And the more we put so many complexities in the way of doing devotional service, our brain, our transcendental intelligence will be very dull. You see, why is it that Prabhupada would glorify simple devotees much more than any of the greatest intellectual politicians and scholars of society? In fact, here in this room, not every devotee has a scholarly propensity. From a material point of view, many devotees are very simple. But Prabhupada would always glorify them, that they are the topmost human beings. Why is that? Because they are serving Krishna. In other words, intelligence as separate from devotional service is worthless. It's just the glare of Maya. We were speaking, remember in the beginning, about the glare of Maya? You're driving down a highway, and someone's coming the opposite way with their high beams on, and it's just a glare. You can't see the road ahead of you.
So you're ultimately, it can get so bad you have to pull off the road until the person passes.
But the glare of Maya is like that. High intensity, blinding light, and it means you can't see. Similarly, people have big brains, it seems, but they cannot see straight. Whereas even so-called simple devotees practicing bhakti yoga, they are at the conclusion of all intelligence. They're practicing the conclusion of the Vedas. We should never overlook the importance of what appears to be routine devotional service, whether it's cleaning the deity paraphernalia, cleaning the floors, all the kinds of service that are needed for a city preaching mission to go on. We should never take them to be just humdrum. They're our chance to develop our love for Krishna. And the more loving our service is performed, then the more we'll be able to hear Krishna in the heart. The physical presence of the spiritual master sometimes is there, sometimes not. Actually, Prabhupada said that the physical presence of the spiritual master is for fools, for neophytes. Of course, naturally, any sincere devotee will respond, well, I'm a fool, I'm a neophyte. So, we don't want to think that all is so advanced that we don't need any physical association with the spiritual master. At the same time, Prabhupada always stressed, it is the mission of the spiritual master that is the most important thing, and actually that's how to get the most ecstatic association. For example, whether they're disciples or grand disciples of Prabhupada, in all the devotees' efforts to carry on Prabhupada's mission, they're feeling association, they're feeling connection. That everyone can practically understand, no matter what their stature is, or how many years they've been a devotee, because they're absorbed in Prabhupada's mission, whether disciples or grand disciples, they feel, yes, we have some, we feel some affection for Prabhupada, we're feeling a great debt. So it is the mission of the spiritual master that gives the most ecstatic association. And the one who quickly realizes that can be most effective in Krishna consciousness. Of course, mission means duty and dedication. And it is duty that sometimes, you don't like duty all the time, because duty means whether you feel like it or not, you do it for the pleasure of somebody else. That was Prabhupada's definition of sadhana bhakti. Sadhana bhakti means you have to do it because I say. The abbreviated version of nectar devotion. You have to do it because I say you have to do it. And then he just laughs. You got to do it. Because Prabhupada says you got to do it. You got to do it. That's sadhana bhakti. Recognizing that in your disease condition, in our disease condition, we cannot prescribe our own medicine. And you'll see this problem, unfortunately, appear amongst even our own devotees, this propensity to prescribe your own medicine and think that good will come of that. No, you will not be able to prescribe your own medicine and serve Krishna effectively to the point where Krishna, from within the heart, will give you intelligence. It won't work that way. Sadhana bhakti means you take the medicine as prescribed by the doctor, and then you'll become free from disease and able to be effective in Krishna's service. When you're doing devotional service, somebody has to be in charge in terms of management. But actually, when you think of it, I never thought of it until I read Prabhupada talking about this, that to be a good leader and manager depends on the followers. In other words, it's the followers that have a great contribution toward making a good leader. If the followers know how to follow, the leader can actually lead. It's not that the followers just kind of sit back and, oh, so are you going to be a good leader or not? Let's see what you're going to do. Do your thing. Come on. Let's see your stuff. Let's see what you're made of. Are you a leader or are you not? What kind of manager are you? It's a reciprocal relationship. In this material world, everything is dependent on something else. So management depends on those who are being managed. So if those who are being managed want good management, they can make a huge contribution toward good management by allowing themselves to be managed. It's amazing these common sense things we overlook. But I never thought of it until I heard Prabhupada say it like that. You generally just think the manager, he's just got to show his stuff regardless of what everybody else does. But the things work in conjunction with one another. If we want good management in our temple, in our farm, then we have to do our part also. We have to be good followers in the sense that we allow ourselves to be managed and coordinated for Krishna's service. And Krishna appreciates the effort and care and love that we do our service with. There's always going to be somebody telling you what to do. If it's not this manager, if it's not your spiritual master, it'll be this, that. You'll never be independent. Impossible. Yamaraj, he's taking direction from the Super Soul. There's no question of a living entity ever finding an independent situation. The sooner we realize that, the better. So just like Yamaraj has achieved this position in which he does his devotional service completely in cooperation with Krishna, in consultation with the Super Soul, we want that also. This is not fairy tale. This is not mythology. We can have it. Krishna promises in Bhagavad Gita, it can be for you. The more we dedicate ourselves to assisting in spreading Srila Prabhupada's mission, the more we will feel association with Prabhupada, with our own spiritual master, and we will also feel Krishna's association. And that is what will enliven us and encourage us to do even, to attempt even more dedication for the pleasure of Krishna. Any questions? What is there that's not Krishna? Just like Lord Brahma prays in the 14th chapter, the 10th canto, prayed by Lord Brahma, he asked Krishna to excuse him. He said, just like a mother is not disturbed when the baby within her womb is kicking. Similarly, he said, Krishna, don't be disturbed by the fact that I tried to play games with you. Everything is within your womb. I'm within your womb, and I may kick a bit, but... you should look upon me just like a mother views the kicking of the child in her womb. Lord Brahma said, there is nothing, whether you consider it real or unreal, that's outside of Krishna. Therefore, the problem with Maya is its attractiveness. Why does Maya have the appearance of attractiveness? Because it's coming from Krishna. But it's only a thin shell attractiveness. The substance is in the spiritual world. Those who are serving Maya are caught up by the perverted attractiveness that Maya presents, which is actually coming from Krishna. Maya's job is to present the material energy as being more attractive than Krishna. But the material energy is Krishna's energy. Maya is Krishna's energy. But it's not the energy we're supposed to be involved with. It's not the way we're supposed to serve. So in the material energy, there is an element of attractiveness, and there is certainly service, but it's not the attractiveness and service we're supposed to be dealing with. Of course, so many people will say, but it all comes from God, therefore. You just tell them, well, poison comes from God, here, have some poison. They won't discriminate in terms of Krishna and service, but they will discriminate in terms of their own sense gratification. Thank you all for your
wonderful association here in Bay and Sydney.